My name's Annie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Annie.
I'm glad to be here. Definitely glad to be sober. I appreciate it. How I ended up in High Rolls, New Mexico is I had one of those sponsors. I'm a native Californian, and I had one of those sponsors. This was 25 years ago, who told me when I was working the steps that I had to make direct amends. And my sister, who I did not like and did not get along with because I was a mess, lived in New Mexico. And she told me I had to hop on a plane and go make direct amends to her. She had married a fellow in college and moved out here and had four kids. So, it was easy for me to fly because being a flight attendant 40 years, I could jump on a plane, but I dreadfully got on the plane and came out to meet this sister or to make personal amends. And I had been horrible. I stole her furniture and sold it and everything else. And it turned out that I had the most wonderful sister ever. And, I made the amends, and I went back home and I told my then husband that you got to see this place. She lives near these beautiful mountains, and so we ended up moving here. And I've been here, I think, 22 years now, and my sister has since. I think she's been a member of Al-Anon for 35 years. Oh, by the way, my sobriety date's November 28th, 1983. And, so that was a long time ago and a lot of lives. I was the first one in our family that was ever in any kind of recovery. My sister wouldn't mind me telling you that her husband now has been sober 28 years and this thing works, you know, but you guys all look really beautiful, healthy, good, respectful. I mean, the whole thing. And I felt that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's not exactly how I looked when I first came here. This last time when I first sat in a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked nothing like you. I had rows and rows of stitches through my scalp and my knees were bruised. I had two black eyes. I had the only pair of jeans left on and I was shaking so hard I had to use two hands and put my mouth down to the table to get a sip of coffee. And I was the happiest I had been since I could remember, because I had finally become willing to do anything you asked and do all that stuff that I thought was so crazy. I was so excited to have another day sober. And the meeting I was sitting in was sitting in the front row of a meeting, and it was very convenient because all I had to do was get on the elevator and go upstairs to my room in this hospital, this jitter joint, that was run by sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And at this point I needed, hospital care. And, you know, it's not that way anymore. However, I still have the excitement and zest and the disbelief that I'm actually living another day without taking a drink, because I never imagined it to be true. I come from a normal alcoholic family. My real nice people. They're sweet and well-meaning, and my parents were married 65 years before my father passed away. But it was a normal alcoholic family. My father drank and my mother was busy hiding his drinking and highly educated. I think my father probably suffered from a little bit of, intellectual arrogance. He had a couple of PhDs and I think he did his dissertation in English literature and semantics. So that tells you that. And also a long line of missionaries and church going people and preachers. And in my house, it was not okay to drink. But my father said, in his keen intellectual description, it's really not correct to drink, but it's okay if I drink because of my understanding and intellectual capacity and translation of the scriptures, blah, 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 blah. He says it's okay if I drink as long as you don't tell anybody. And, they won't understand. And, so in our house, it was a look good family. You know, we didn't see his face in the dinner plate and we didn't see that streak of blood on the rug. And as long as you don't tell anybody, it's not happening. It's like a big pink elephant in the middle of the room. And I get it. I totally understand that. You know, I will go to, and I, that's who I became. I would go to any lengths to protect my right to drink. And if that's what it took, that's what it took. My mother needed Al-Anon. After I got sober, she did go to Al-Anon. She's still living. She's 91 and just as spry as could be. But believe me, I'll never get over having to make an amends. My mother recently said to my girlfriend, my main goal in life was keeping Annie alive. So if that, I was just a wild kid, but they were a loving family and I'd love to say my father made me an alcoholic, you know, in fact, I blamed him for my alcoholism, for years and years and years, but I'm an alcoholic because alcohol does for me what it does for so many of you, if not all in this room. It just makes everything okay. And really for me, it didn't make me more beautiful or taller or less awkward. It just made me not care because I suffer from self-centered fear and self-obsession from the day I was born. My very first memory, I was in kindergarten or going to kindergarten. My mother was letting me out to go in. And all I remember, and this is my first memory, is stark raving fear. You know, I wouldn't be good enough. I wouldn't fit in. I didn't look right. I was just terrified. I was anxious. I was nervous, afraid of people, places and things. And as it goes, I learned how to deal with that and made friends later in life. But, you know, it was tough. I was uncomfortable. And if you want to know exactly how I felt, probably be a good idea just to read the doctor's opinion. You know, it describes me to a T. And there's nothing that an alcohol, a couple drinks of alcohol wouldn't fix at once. So, but I didn't have alcohol and I was a kid and I just, it was miserable. But I made friends and went along and, you know, I had a drink or two now and then. And then I didn't drink too much because I was seeing what it done in my, did in my family. And I was scared of it. And then somewhere along the way, and I don't have a really good recollection of time or dates or anything like that, but some of my girlfriends in junior high or high school said, "Hey, Annie, there's this party going on and these guys are graduating they're going to get ready to go to college and they have an apartment. Do you want to go to this party?" And I said, "Sure." So I snuck out of the window as we all do and went to this party. And, these guys were serving 151 rum and coke. And, for some reason this night, I had a couple of stiff ones, drinks, that is. And I absolutely loved it. My life changed right then. I had no idea. And of course that became my goal. It no longer scared me, obviously. I didn't care about consequences, how I felt the next day or anything like that. I just, I really like to drink. So I drank whenever I could and came time to to move. My father got a job in a new university that was opening up in Malibu. And so we moved to that town near there and made new friends, and they drank, and really nothing happened. I got in a little trouble, but one night I woke up, and when I came to, I was sitting in somebody's apartment, and there were cops all around me, and I was in high school, and we'd been drinking out of my friend's father's bar, and I guess I'd totaled a couple parked cars I wasn't really hurt, but I was in a heap of trouble. I had a reckless driving then, or a drunk driving, what it did is my parents were absolutely mortified, because you don't understand, you know, what are people going to think, and what are they going to look like in the church and all that kind of thing. And so it was rough, but you know, came time to go to college, and I went to that university in Malibu. And of course, right away I had to start with, finding a way to drink and finding a way to join the Christian sorority and play both sides of the, you know, I had to drink. So, and I always had jobs. I had a couple of jobs while I was in college. I had one job as a cocktail waitress in this beautiful restaurant overlooking the ocean in Malibu. I was so uncomfortable. And I just, one night the bartender said to me, Annie, why don't you sneak back here and I'll give you a shooter. And I thought, well, yeah, okay. And I took a shot or two of whatever it was. And I was like, this job's fabulous. I love these people. They're great. You know, it changed everything. And I would sneak into the walk-in refrigerator and get that bottle of booze and just glug it down. And my point in that is, my pattern from there on out is, once I did something behind alcohol, I never did it again sober. I couldn't imagine. So, yeah, that, and I had another job in a children's clothing store, and it was a family owned store, and I kept my bottle in the back of the toilet, and I would go out there, and I mean, I was selling, I had every sales award there was known to man, because I just loved everybody, and I would cram those poor kids' feet in a pair of shoes, and you know, it was, and then I started to steal the clothes and sell them, and I don't know why. I just started to have behavior that was, everything was behind drinking, and everything was hungover, and it was, it, you know, it already had become really hard work. So I somehow was making it through college, and I had some good friends that I still see all these years later. I graduated in 78, and we meet every year. But those friends back there in 1977, the year before I was graduating, pulled me aside, and you know, none of us had heard of AA or Al-Anon back then, and they took me out to a meal, and they said, Annie, we think you have a problem with alcohol. And I was absolutely mortified. I guess they had gone to a couple AA meetings and Al-Anon meetings, and, you know, they really cared. And my only thought was, you'd think I would say, maybe I should do something about it. But what I said was, you don't understand. If you grew up with the family I had, and you had the dad I had, and you would drink too. And I'm more sensitive than the normal person, and my feelings are so pronounced, and I have to drink, and you know, just my battle cry, all our battle cry, you know, you don't understand, and my case is different. And what I did was just stay away from them. You know, I'm not going to change my drinking, but I better hide it better. So, that's what I tried to do. I did have a couple of friends that would smoke a doobie to go to sleep. And, you know, I was never into that. And I thought, well, maybe I can drink a little less but I'll never sleep again. I mean, how many of us have thought we'd never sleep again if we quit drinking? How do people sleep? Because yeah, I didn't sleep. I passed out, but I didn't care. So I tried a little of that and I thought, oh God, I can't wait till this wears off because I need a cocktail. So, came time to graduate from, college and I got into the I don't know how I graduated. I saw a picture recently. My bloated, red, shaking person. And I was 22 years old and I got into the public relations field. And now I couldn't stand it. I had to wear pumps and carry a little skinny briefcase and, you know, I had to get my flask in there and it wouldn't fit in there. And I had to keep sneaking out to the car and, you know, I had to keep the shakes off. I had a bottle in my glove compartment. Nothing like warm vodka in the glove compartment. And then I had to find under my bed and, you know, always in my purse. And it was just kind of miserable. And about then my really good girlfriend from college came to me and she said, Annie, you know, I'm going to go down to the airport. I've always wanted to be a flight attendant. And I hadn't heard of that. I'd heard of stewardess. I said, well, what is that? Is that person that serves cocktails on the plane? And she said, yeah. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, I want to do that too. So I went down with her and filled out some applications. And lo and behold, it was 1979 and United Airlines was on strike and they needed people right away. And lo and behold, I get this thing in the mail from the other AA. And they want to interview me. So, you know, I was raised by a mom that was taught me how to dress for business and all that kind of thing. So I went down to the airport and had a nice suit on and I got ready for this interview. And of course, the airlines were a little different then. And I did the only thing I know how to do. I sat in the parking lot across from the interview and I drank a bottle of wine. And when I went in, I was one of two hired out of the 3,000 interviewees. So that week, and alcohol was still working. It was working great. So they sent me off to training and now I'm going to training in Dallas, Texas. And I was raised on a surfboard at the beach. I didn't know anything about other places or weather. So I grabbed my windbreakers and my flip flops and all my clothes and went to training. And just because you make it to training doesn't mean you're going to make it out. I lost two of my three roommates and it was the last time I didn't drink for a couple of days. And then after that, of course, we find a way to drink. I found a bar and, graduated. And the last day they said, Annie, you're going to Chicago. And I thought, oh, Chicago. Okay. There's a lot of Irish people there and you got to stay, you got to drink a lot, stay warm and, that'll work. So off I was with this new job in Chicago, Illinois, and we had no cell phones. We just had beepers, and I loved it because it was all new set of circumstances and friends and, you know, be nothing for it to be 4 a.m. Our beeper would go off. We had to run home and get, you know, our uniform on and get to the airport. I was miserable though. I was already, you know, still hiding the booze but at least I had, new circumstances and new friends that were drinking you're on probation for 6 months. So for 6 months, you know, you're kind of on your toes. And one morning the beeper went off downtown Chicago and we got back to the suburbs and got our uniforms on. I got on the airplane and I was on probation. There was my supervisor and they were going to do this check ride where they check all your phases of flight. And, you know, I was absolutely terrified. So I thought there's no way I can serve a drink or push a cart without something. I just can't do it. So I took a chance and I took a couple of minis of vodka and I went in the lavatory and shot them down and I came out and I did great and eventually got off probation. And that's my point again. And that is once I did that, I never worked another sober trip until I finally got sober, because I couldn't imagine working or functioning without alcohol. And so now it's becoming a chore. And I figured out if I got this flask, held a quart of vodka, and I kept it in my flight bag. God, I hope you guys haven't seen that movie, Flight, because it's that's the life I started to live, and we were all partying like crazy. It was the early, 1980, I guess, 80, 81, and the girls would say, I got to go freshen up in the lavatory, and they'd take their lipstick in, and I'd take my tote bag in, and then I'd go crashing in there and come out, and my eyes are watering, and now I'm getting to the point where if my flask halfway through the day got halfway empty, I'd start to already worry that I'd have enough for that night, and I'd take the miniatures and pour them in, and I never want to forget how much work it was to protect my right to drink. All the thought and the work and the hiding and the perfume and the just constant. And about now I had an opportunity to transfer back to LA, and I thought, these are great people, but I don't want to wear out my welcome. So I got to Los Angeles. I transferred and it wouldn't be right if I didn't tell you how nuts, just a couple examples of how nuts my behavior became behind drinking. I had a crew that we flew. We were super junior, and we flew all night and stopped in, I think it was Indianapolis, and then ended up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where there's a university town. And we were all friends, and we were all junior, and they were all nighters. And a couple of trips in, my friend said, hey, Annie, next trip, we're going to bring our roller skates. It's when everybody was roller skating. We're going to roller skate around campus from bar to bar. And I said, I don't have roller skates. And I kind of threw in that when I was a kid, I had a unicycle that I rode. And they're like, unicycle? And I go, yeah, I still have that old thing. And they said, you bring your unicycle on the trip. And I said, no way. And then they said those three words that did it every time, we dare you. So next trip, I am rolling at night through LAX with my suitcase on one side and rolling my unicycle behind me. And I get on the DC-10 and I put it in the back closet. I mean, it just seems unreal when I think about it now. But about halfway through the flight, the captain calls back and he says, Annie, we used to get paid by, they had to sign our name off on a paper sheet. There were no computers. So, Danny, I'm not going to turn in your pay sheet unless you deliver your next tray of drinks riding down that aisle on that unicycle. And I said, oh God, Captain, by the way, he's been sober 30 years. So, I said, there's no way. And he said, well, we dare you. And so there I was off riding my unicycle down the aisle delivering drinks. The lights are on. People are going crazy. And after I got sober, I was sitting on a panel with two or three flight attendants that got sober in Skid Row or somewhere. And I told that little story. And my friend, who's a flight attendant, I told mine, then she told her. She goes, before I start, I just want to mention that Annie doesn't remember I was the purser on that flight. No, not only was she on the unicycle, but she had red glasses with flashing bulbs around them going down the aisle. So I'm getting crazier and crazier and drunker and drunker. And, they roll up a closet and I'd be passed out on it was the day of the fur coats, on the fur coats, and I was on the 747 one time, we had three carts. First the beverage, then the entree, then the drinks. I mean, first the trays. And I'd do the trays because it was like you could be hungover or drunk and just plop the tray down. And I plopped the tray down a couple times. And then I was the first one in line on that 747. They said, hey, Annie didn't come up. And so they had to crawl over the seats, and I was in there. I had really long hair at the time, and I'd gone in for a tray, and my hair got stuck in a metal rung in there. And so I just decided I was tired. I needed a nap. And so they had to get in there, cut my hair off with toenail clippers. I have endless alcoholic behavior, but the truth of the matter was I would get to my hotel room and I'd be in a layover. And as funny as this is, I would say you're nothing but an alcoholic. I couldn't not drink. And I'd look in the mirror and I'd spit on myself. I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I knew I had to be one. And then I'd take another drink. And, at this point, I couldn't imagine not flying because it was like the only identity, only thing I had left. And I thought, well, at least I have this job, but one day something's going to happen. And that day did happen. And, I'd gone to a doctor and my liver was shot and my parents had found out and I guess they were going to fire me the next day because, at the job. So some sober, members of Alcoholics Anonymous that were flight attendants got with my parents and my family and they waited for me in Hermosa Beach, California in an alley for me to come out of a bar and they did an intervention and they all, held hands and said the Lord's Prayer and they had a rehab place set up for me and, I was so mortified. You know, we don't care about, it's okay to ride a unicycle down the aisle, but God forbid I go to rehab. And, so I went to this program run by Sober Alcoholics and great people. And I needed the hospital care at that point. And I got out in 28 days and I still had my job. Gosh, I'd lost all this bloat and I felt better and I looked better. And I said, I never want to forget, if nothing else, the physical freedom, I have from not drinking alcohol, the constant thought that there's places I couldn't go, the constant thoughts of having enough. And my life was so limited to wherever I could drink. It was so much work. It's so much work to drink like I drink. So I got out and that's what I felt like. I thought, I'm really, really glad to look better and feel better. And somebody made themselves my sponsor and we had to go to meetings. And, I'd go to a meeting if there was a parking spot up close. And afterwards I'd go to, if there was nothing good on TV, I might stay for the whole thing, and I'd call my sponsor. If she called me enough times, I'd call her back. And I thought, good for this AA people. The one thing I knew is that these people cared, but I thought, somehow my case is a little different. I think I'm a little brighter than them or something. So I went a year and a half and I thought they just get a little bit carried away with all that showing up all the time at 90 and 90 step work. And I thought, good for them. But I always thought too that I never had a problem with drugs and I was so nervous and I had to go back to work and I said, I am sober, don't you know? But, I'm so nervous to go in the cart. And my neighbor said, well, I'll sell you, these Quaaludes. Just a bag of 500 and you can sell some. And I said, well, those will help me relax. So, I sold two tablets, but I got on that cart and I'm going to tell you, I was relaxed. And, I would go to a party with people and say, I have no problem with sobriety. I feel great. And, I would get to a party and, I don't know about any of you guys, but back then, we do a little substance to maybe keep the drinking happening longer. Well, I tried a little of it. I said, no, they'd offer me a drink at the party. I said, nope, I'm sober. But I can have a little line of that just, you know, to stay up late, to stay later, but I don't drink, don't you know? And I don't know about you, but I'd try that. And, I couldn't understand why I was so nervous. I just wasn't feeling well. And then things were going well. I thought they were going great, but they weren't going well. And then it was about a year and a half later, my girlfriend got a cold, and I thought, well, shoot, I could catch that cold. So I went and drank, just in case I was going to get it, I drank a few bottles of NyQuil, you know, and then that made my tongue so green that I switched to Listerine, and then that made me kind of sick. And I'll never forget the day. Here I am. I have absolutely no spiritual solution. You know, I believe there's a God and all that, but I'm in control of all this. I'm sober, don't you know? I'm fine. And I found myself in the parking lot, and to this day I remember the spot and walking in there and getting a pint of vodka and drinking that down. And I could breathe, because I'm an alcoholic with absolutely no spiritual solution. And I need a drink. So I felt fantastic for about 20 minutes. And then in our book, they talk about a progression. The progression is astonishing, and it will lead us into the gates of insanity or death. I thought I could never get sicker than I was the first time I came in. I was very sick. And I'm here to tell you that we could get sicker. If we stay alive, we're going to get sicker. And at least that's my case. And I had an apartment. I ended up sleeping in my van, and I ended up in alleys where I shouldn't have been. I was beat up by another, we called him winos, alcoholic, in an alley, trying to get some booze from him in my uniform. I ended up, things happening to me that happened to women alcoholics. And, it was really bad. I still hadn't gone back to work this time. I had always found a way out. And I guess it was about, I don't know how long afterwards. I'd had a boyfriend that was getting in the way. He was suspecting my drinking. How could you not? And so I sent him off to rehab. I told him he had a problem with alcohol, and so he went off to rehab. And when he came out, he accused me of drinking. Can you imagine? And living in my van and sleeping in my van. And he had gotten this thing. He had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober. And he says, Annie, I know you're drinking. What we can do is, you don't have to go to a hospital. You don't have to go to a program. You can get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where you need to end up, and that's where you need to end up living today. But I told him I was terrified. I was terrified of coming off alcohol, and I was so sick. So he took me up to a place. We spent the night, and then he watched me while I came off alcohol. And about 2 or 3 days later, we started driving back home. And next thing you know, I woke up in a hospital. I'd had the first of many grand mal seizures coming off alcohol. I'd seen some green dinosaurs crossing the road. And then next thing you know, I'm in a hospital. And that boyfriend had to depart to protect his own sobriety. And so I lived in a little studio apartment in Westwood, California, and my parents had helped me get in it. And I would want to get sober, and so I would call some of those people I'd met the first time around, one of the nurses and one of the members, and say, I really want to get sober, but I'm afraid to. So they'd come and take me to a meeting and feed me honey and orange juice so I could get off the alcohol. And, you know, I would get on my knees and pray, God, help me stop drinking. And I go back to that little studio apartment and I'd get scared and I'd somehow get out and get another bottle. And this, I had a bed that just had three legs on it. It was tilted and there were cockroaches. I'd spray Raid around the bed every night. And I ate every few days. I don't even remember. I thought, well, I've got one thing left. And after a long series of events, I said, I still have that job, but it's my last chance. I need to show up in a state of insanity. I need to show up. I thought it was at midnight that night, to go to Dallas and back. So I got in my van and I put I remember distinctly finding some uniform pieces and putting them on. And then I took the state of insanity I was in. I put my suitcase in the car and a half gallon of vodka behind my seat. And I'm heading at night out to the airport. And the next thing you know, I come to and I'm lying in, I don't know if anybody's familiar with Westwood, California, UCLA. The area is so busy and it's a lot of honking and a lot of cars and it's just really crazy busy. And I'm lying in the middle of Wilshire Boulevard and I look over and there's my van's totaled over there and I just feel wet. And, then I kind of realized I had no physical pain. I just realized that, you know, I was covered in my own blood and I looked around and there's a hospital, UCLA hospital nearby. A nurse on her way to work, she came up, she looked down at me, she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Why do you care?" And then it's as if every sound and every light went off. I mean, except for just, it all got really quiet. And I just had a weird feeling. And then all of a sudden, this beautiful man's face looked down at me and I said words I had never really meant or said before. I said, "I'm an alcoholic. I can't stop drinking and I need help." And he just smiled. He said, "Don't worry. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have 7 years." I'd never said those words before. And he was the policeman. And at that moment, that was our window. You know, so many of us have a window. And I was there for it. And he was there for it. And I don't call those coincidences. And he took me in his police car, risking his job. And he sat with me all night long in that hospital. And sometime in the morning he left and a nurse gave me a ride home because of course I have no car. And now I'm in my apartment and I don't care how huge a surrender I've had. I'm an alcoholic and I have no solid solution, no car, nothing around me. My parents by now, and I think it had a lot to do with it, had told me, "We can't help you anymore." My mother had gotten some Al-Anon. And I just thought I'd look around and there was no shoe polish. There was no leftover vodka. There was nothing. And I sat there and I said, "Oh God, help me." And the telephone rang and it was that first, that gal that did the intervention, the sober flight attendant, member of AA. And she said, "American Airlines has made an exception and you are the first case on the books that they're going to actually put you through a different rehab," because I was pretty sick and I needed hospital care with those same people as before. And that's when you could find me in that first row in that hospital, torn up, so happy to be sober. And you know, to this day, I'm so happy to be sober. And I never struggled with a God of my understanding, but I absolutely knew that I have a loving God that wants me to have the purpose of staying sober and helping somebody else. you know, I find that no matter what goes wrong in my life, if I'm helping somebody else, I'm better. You know, that job that was drudgery on the plane became a means of service. I don't can tell you how many AA meetings we had in that galley, and I got busy with service in and outside of AA. I got busy with Patch Adams doing trips overseas, helping other kids, and we had a group of flight attendants. And my last year, I went to Morocco. I'm still doing it, and I became the EAP rep, like that gal that was helping me. And I haven't had an unbelievable life. Like I said, I got real busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, but then it became time to go back to work. And I'm like, oh no. I told my sponsor, I think it's great and everything, but you don't understand. I get so nervous if I have to push a cart or serve a drink. And she goes, well, God's the answer. What's the question? And I said, no, my case is a little different. I just really get nervous. And she said the most important words I've heard in my entire sobriety, and that I use today. And it's like, so what? Who cares? Do it anyway. So to this day, no matter what one of my sponsees or what I'm going through, I don't care how many days or years I have. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a human being. And I just take the action despite how I feel. And my life's fantastic. I don't want to do a lot of stuff. I don't want to go on a computer screen with dogs running around my computer with people I don't know. But I love it because what's happened to my life, it's become magical. A few more things. I think I have a little more time. I was 2 years sober and my husband was 4 years sober, and we thought we had a ton of time. So we got married, and we had a wedding in the backyard of our parents' house, and it was all potluck. We had no money, obviously. And, 40 feet of tables of food. And Roger and I had a fantastic life. The reason I liked Roger is he loved Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I did. And, I guess it was about 20 years ago, he was diagnosed with a autoimmune disease. They gave him 5 years and he made it 20. He lived till 2 years ago. And, I have no doubt it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I mean, people say, how did you stay married so long? I go, well, number one, I travel for a living. But number two, we both have a sponsor, our own program. And, my point in that is when we would get in that hospital, all these people would come and visit Roger and bring food. And, ironically, it was the same hospital I was in that night. And the doctor finally pulled me aside one night and he says, I need to know something. You've got so many people that come to see you and they all say they're family and none of them look a damn bit like you. And, he says, I've never seen anything like it. They're kind to your husband, but they're kind to the other patients. And I told this guy the story of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, this is the fellowship. This is how it works for us. And I started speaking around a little bit, because it was one kind of service I could take a commitment on, because I couldn't take a regular meeting at my home group here because I don't know where I'd be in China or Sydney or, you know, so, I started speaking around locally in LA and locally or rather in, you know, conventions. But this one month, I always had a girlfriend that went with me and I was speaking in, Hermosa Beach, California. And I was tired. I'd just come in from New York and I said, she always went with me. She goes, I'm so sick of your story. Would you change it? And I changed it up a little. And I said, well, geez. So little did I know it would change up that night. I was telling the story. And when I got to the part about my policeman, I heard a little rustling in the audience. And so afterwards, when people come up to thank you, it came to this guy in line and he had tears running down his face. And he says, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic and I'm your policeman. I've been looking for you for 14 years. And at the time I was an active member of Bellflower Big Book Group in California, and everybody knew my story. And that year John came and gave me my cake at that meeting. How does that happen? How does that happen? And John and I stay close. I said, John, was I imagining things? I mean, when I tell the story, you know, as an alcoholic, if I've been to Europe twice, I would say three times. I mean, I said, I know we tend to exaggerate, but is it kind of how I said? He says, exactly. He said, I even remember the direction the gurney was facing. He said it was such a spiritual experience for both of us that he had been looking for me. So John and I stay in touch. And when my husband passed away a couple of years ago, I had a little AA type service here in Hyrule's, New Mexico. And I also had one in California because we'd come from there and we stay connected, and that Hermosa Beach Club where I'd met John. And when I sat in that service, that memorial, and looked up, in the front row was my mother and my sister. And next to my mother was John. And, you know, I could have missed it. Any one thing I could have missed. And so if I don't think that I need to be there when anybody asks for help, I'm sorely mistaken and missing it, because any one of those things I could have missed. Gosh, there's so many things. I just know that courtesy, kindness, justice, and love are what we need to do. I also know that the things I don't have control of is my past. I don't have any control of you. I do know I have, and I don't have any control of the truth, but I do have control of my thinking. I do have control of my attitudes, and I have control of my behavior. And, you know, I need to remember that. I did get to meet Mother Teresa before she passed away, and that woman was nothing but service. And many of you may have heard this, but when she was asked by a reporter what her secret was or something, and she said, the fruit of faith is love. And she said, the fruit of love is service. And then she said, the fruit of service is peace. And we shall know a new freedom and experience peace. The fruit of service is peace. And believe me, I'm not always great at it, but that's what I'm striving for. God, as I understand him, gives me the ability to walk through all that fear and all life. You know, so what if I'm uncomfortable? If you're uncomfortable long enough, I feel like I'll take a drink. So I just keep remembering, so what, who cares, and do it anyway. And I'm so grateful to be sober. Thank you for inviting me to this meeting.